T-minus 37 seconds, and our count continues to go well. We'll be looking for an ignition of those five first stage engines at the T-minus 8.9 second mark. We pass T-minus 30, T-minus 25 seconds and counting, and Apollo 13 is go. T-minus 20 seconds, T-minus 20 seconds and counting. 17, guidance release, 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8. Ignition sequence has started. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit and we have liftoff at 2:13. The Saturn V building up to 7.6 million pounds of thrust, and it has cleared the tower.
Starting up to mission control.
Here we go. It's a beauty. It's another beauty.
No, I think it's a Jack's flight.
The projection looks good. They show a 1.5 mile in altitude at this time. 13 Houston, go in 30 seconds.
Houston, say again, please.
Yes, sir. Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main B bus undervolt.
Roger, main B undervolt. Okay, stand by, 13. We're looking at it.
And we had a pretty large bang associated with the caution and warning there. And as I recall, main B...
Guys, I just want to let you know something.
We're not experts. We're not professionals. Hell, I ain't even sober right now. So,
take it with a grain of salt, as they say.
We're here to have fun. We're here to get lost in thought and take you on a trip. Nothing more, guys. Nothing less.
All right, Josh, that was the countdown and some recordings from the Apollo 13 mission.
Wow, man, how intense was that?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, though. Stacy was back here listening with me yesterday, and she heard it for the first time. And she's just, I mean, she's close to the monitor, and she's soaking it all in, and she goes, why did they just skip 7?
Did they really?
They skipped 7, if you listen. But I was like, you got to think, in real time, when you're counting down, I mean, if you can't, it ain't like he can be like, say 7 really fast. Like, if it's at 6, you got to say 6.
Yeah, he's got to keep with that cadence.
Oh, yeah. You know, well, when I used to produce football games, when I was working in radio, one of my first jobs in radio was producing football games. Well, it was kind of, I really thought, it seemed like it was a bigger gig than what it really was.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was just high school football games, but you have to do a countdown in and out of commercials and begin with for whoever it is that's actually announcing the game.
Uh-huh.
And it's all remote, so I would actually pretend that I was doing a countdown for, like, an Apollo mission. I really would, because you have to do the countdown for them. And I was like, and I took it so serious. Like, in my head, I was right there, like, waiting for the shuttle to launch. But, yeah, so I always thought that I was that guy. So hearing him actually do the countdown, it's, man, that was a dream job for me.
No, I got you. I got you.
But, man, how's your week, man?
Man, it's been pretty good. We finished up the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez.
Dude. Awesome.
Yes, we had some killer feedback from basically the Facebook page for the most part.
Yeah, Richard Dick Ramirez.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've given him his nickname.
Big shout out to Mickey Stanhope, who commented. He left us a lot of good information and really gave us a glimpse into his life. And we really appreciate you stepping up and commenting and interacting with this man.
Man, dude, yeah, like our the Instagram and our Facebook was blowing up with it. And it literally was some of the people was these. It was an, I remember there was an older Hispanic lady that was commenting that was actually there when it happened. Basically, she said that they wanted to kill him, but the older generation that was around, the older Hispanics, wouldn't allow it to happen.
Oh, man, they wanted him to see justice.
Yeah, he went into a Hispanic community, though, after like his face was in every newspaper, and they just went after him.
Yeah. So before we really get started on our next episode, man, want to go back through all of our social media presence, let you guys know where we're at. Be YouTube at Lost in Thought Media, Instagram at Stay Lost in Thought, and Facebook at Lost in Thought.
You actually got it right that time.
I did, man.
It is not always first time every time.
No, it's not. No, it's not. But,
so, dude, the Apollo mission.
Yes. Yes.
I dig this. So, I'm going to go ahead and confess, even though I'm a history nerd, I love science, I really know nothing about the Apollo missions.
And that baffles me because I grew up knowing everything I possibly could about it. Watching the Apollo 13 movie back in 95 when it came out. Can't believe it came out back in 95. It makes me feel old now.
That's what I was looking it up, and it was like, oh, the movie from 95. And I was like, wait, there was another movie in 95?
Yeah, I was like,
and then I was like, Tom Hanks. And I was like, I thought that was early 2000s.
Yeah.
So what exactly is the Apollo mission? Like, what are we doing today?
The Apollo mission was originally planned to be the third landing on the moon by NASA. It didn't go so well. So we're going to start in 1961, when President John F. Kennedy challenged the nation to land an astronaut on the moon by the end of the decade. And he tasked NASA with doing this. They began with Project Mercury and then with Project Gemini, leading up to the Apollo program. The moon landing was achieved during the Apollo 11 mission. And that happened on July 20 of 1969 with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, who was accompanied by Michael Collins in the orbiter, who did not land on the moon.
How sucky would it be to be that guy?
Man, everybody's got their purpose. It's got their mission. You know, maybe he didn't want to be the guy that had to go out into space. They returned to Earth on July 24th, 1969, fulfilling John Kennedy's promise of landing a man on the moon. Now, NASA had contracted for 15 Saturn V rockets to make this goal achievable. And at the time, no one knew how many missions it would actually take to get to the moon. And success was obtained in 1969 with the sixth Saturn V rocket on Apollo 11, there were 9 remaining rockets available for a hopeful of 10 landings on the moon. After the excitement of Apollo 11, the general public, they grew apathetic towards the space program and pushed for Congress to cut NASA's budget some. I mean, it's like, we achieved our mission. Maybe we don't need to put so much money into it. And the Apollo 20 mission was canceled. Now, despite the successful lunar landing, the missions were considered so risky that astronauts could not afford life insurance to be covered if they went into space.
See, I didn't know that part.
I didn't either, but I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. And how do you, you know, how would you file a claim for something that didn't happen on Earth?
We've got farmers. Even before the first United States astronaut had entered space in 1961, in 1965, a mission control center was established in Houston. It was designed in part by Kraft and named for him. In mission control, each flight controller, in addition to monitoring telemetry for the spacecraft, was in direct communication via a voice loop to specialists in a staff support room, commonly referred to as the back room, and they focused on specific spacecraft systems. Apollo 13 was to be the second of the H mission, which was meant to demonstrate precision lunar landings and explore different landing sites on the moon. Now, with Kennedy's goal accomplished by Apollo 11, and Apollo 12 was demonstrating that the astronauts could perform precision landings on the moon, mission planners were able to focus more and more on just safely landing and having astronauts trained to do things like mining and other experiments so they could actually take home samples from Earth.
That's right. It's not Bitcoin mining.
No, it's not, which I'm a huge fan of, by the way. We'll get into that later. This was a greater role in science for the Apollo 13 missions, especially for geology, and it was something that was emphasized by the mission's motto, Ex Luna Scientia, which meant from the moon, knowledge.
Fancy.
Yeah. So let's move on to our personnel.
Who all we got?
Yeah, first up we have Apollo 13's mission commander, Jim Lovell, who was 42 years old at the time of his space flight, and which was his fourth and final flight.
I want you to think about this for a minute.
Okay.
This cat is only a couple years older than us.
Yeah, we're behind.
So yeah, it's insane to me. I still haven't realized like how old we're getting. Because you hear like 42-year-old, and it's like, oh yeah, by the way, he went to the moon.
Yeah.
And it's like somebody my age went to the moon.
Yeah. Lovell was a graduate of the United States Naval Academy and was a test pilot before becoming part of the second group of astronauts selected in 1962. He flew with Frank Borman in the Gemini 7 in 1965 and also worked with Buzz Aldrin in the Gemini 12 mission right before Apollo 8 in 1968, which that was the first spacecraft to orbit the moon. At the time of Apollo 13, Lovell, he was the NASA astronaut with the most time in space, with a grand total of 572 hours over three missions.
He was the MVP of NASA at the time.
Yes, he was. Next up was Jack Swaggart, the Command Module Pilot, or CMP for short. He was 38 years old, and he had a Bachelor in Science in Mechanical Engineering and a Master in Science in Aerospace Science. He had served in the Air Force and in the State Air National Guards. He was also an engineering test pilot before being selected to the fifth group of astronauts in 1966, 4 years after Lovell was selected. Now, Fred Hayes, the Lunar Module Pilot, LMP, was only 35 years old. He was the youngest of them all. And 2 years younger than me? 3 years?
Yeah. Hello.
Yeah. He held a BS in Aeronautical Engineering and had been a Marine fighter pilot. He was also a civilian research pilot for NASA when he was selected to become an astronaut. So, I mean, these guys knew their stuff.
Yeah, and each one of them had these wild cowboy personalities. Like, they had a... I loved listening to them speak. Just the way they handled themselves. And these three were some crazy, crazy guys.
They were more like cowboys to me than they were astronauts.
They really were like space cowboys.
Yeah. Now, according to the standard Apollo crew rotation, the prime crew for Apollo 13 would have been the backup crew for Apollo 10 from the Mercury and Gemini missions. And that was going to be veteran Gordon Cooper in command, with Don F. Ezel as CMP and Edgar Mitchell as the LMP. Another man, Deke Slayton, who was NASA's Director of Flight Crew Operations, never intended to rotate Cooper and Ezel to a prime assignment. But they were both out of favor. Cooper had a lax attitude towards training, and Ezel had incidents aboard Apollo 7 and also was in trouble for having an extramarital affair. So they wanted to keep these guys on the straight and narrow, for sure.
Well, you got to think, it was glitz and glamour, man. It was PR. It was, you know, the astronauts represented the people's money, the taxes being spent.
Yeah.
So, I mean, 1960s, 1970, you can't really have affairs on your stuff. Yeah.
So they were assigned to be the backup crew because there were no other veteran astronauts available. And Slayton's original choices for Apollo 13 were actually Alan Shepard as commander, Stuart Rosa as CMP, and Mitchell as the LMP. That wasn't the case, however, as management felt Shepard needed more training and he just wasn't ready. And he had only recently resumed active status after having a surgery for an inner ear disorder. That's really probably got to mess with you during spaceflight.
Oh, dude, you're already, I mean, you're floating around, weird noises on top of that.
Yeah. Thus, Lovell's crew, himself, Hayes, and Ken Mattingly at the time, they haven't all backed up the Apollo 11 crew, and they were slated for Apollo 14. But they were swapped with Shepard's crew because they felt they were the more well-trained at the time.
Man, it's like the worst game of somebody getting promoted ahead of you.
How I would be fighting mad. I would be absolutely fighting mad. Swaggart, he was originally CMP of Apollo 13's backup crew, with a man named John Young, who was supposed to be the commander, and another man named Charles Duke, who was supposed to be the lunar module pilot. About a week before the launch, Duke contracted rubella from a friend of his son's. And they were exposed, both the prime and the backup crews who trained together. So of all the crews, of the five, there was only Mattingly who was not immune through prior exposure. And normally, if any crew member or prime member had to be grounded, the remaining crew would be replaced as well. Now, wouldn't that make you mad if one guy screwed it up for everybody?
Bro, no joke.
Yeah, absolutely. But Mattingly actually never developed rubella, and he later flew on Apollo 16. So while he wasn't able to be on this one, it did not completely scrub him from missions.
Yeah, so rubella is basically an infection. It's the German measles is what it is.
Ah, so for you guys out there who weren't well-versed in it, now you know. It's a contagious viral infection. It's got a bad red rash. Now, for Apollo, a third of the crew of the astronauts, known as the support crew, were designated in addition to the prime and backup crews to be used on projects Mercury and Gemini. Slayton created the support crew because James McDivitt, who was the actual commander of Apollo 9, believed that with proper prep going in on facilities across the United States, there would be meetings that would be held and that needed a number of the flight crew to be present, and that wasn't going to happen. So support crew members were to assist as directed by the mission commander. It's usually low in seniority, but they assembled the mission's rules, the flight plan, the checklist, and kept everything updated. Now, the flight directors for Apollo 13 were Gene Kranz, head of the white team, who was the lead flight director. There was Glenn Looney. There was the black team, which was Milton Windler, maroon team, and Jerry Griffin from the gold team. The Capcoms, which was the people really in charge of personal mission control during the Apollo crew program as astronauts, who were responsible for voice communications with the crew. And for Apollo 13, they were Curran, Brand, Luisma, Young, and Mattingly.
You know, and those guys, the guys that were actually on the ground, so much respect.
Yeah, like, they don't get near enough respect. I mean, there had to have been a real, what am I trying to say? You had to have been in sync between the ground crew and the flight crew. And there wasn't much room for error. And yeah, people gave a lot of credit to the astronauts, but I think a lot more credit needs to be given to people within mission control.
Oh, dude, absolutely, man. You know, Houston does not get the credit they deserve.
So, dude, why don't you tell us about the launch vehicle and the craft that was supposed to get them into outer space?
Dude, the Saturn V rocket used to carry the Apollo 13 to the moon was numbered SA-508, and it was almost identical to those used on Apollo 8 all the way up through, like, 12.
Okay,
so
gotcha.
It was, yeah, so they basically used pretty much the same rockets from 8 all the way up and going into 13.
They were pretty big, weren't they?
Oh, dude, they were huge. So it's a 100,000 foot-pounds is what it's looking like. Like, 440,000 newtons. What is a newton?
That is actually the amount of thrust that they're generating while they're firing.
See,
the Saturn V rocket itself weighed about 6.5 million pounds.
Jeez, and dude.
It was capable of generating 440,000 newtons of total thrust. Now, that's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, what do you got to think? You know, the space shuttle itself is, it consists of multiple parts. Like, when people look at it, they think that it's literally just piece, you know, it's just one big shuttle.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's actually different little, you know, it's broken into different areas and literally into different pieces. It's like a Legos that you stuck together.
Nice. I like that analogy.
But, I actually met one time, man, this old guy. He was probably in his late 80s, early 90s. But we ended up talking to him, me and a friend of mine. And he was the one that actually was on the team that invented what separates the shuttles.
Oh, wow.
So whenever the shuttle goes into different stages, he said they were sitting in the room and they were trying to decide, try to figure out how they were going to make the stages work. How do we literally make the shuttles come apart? Well, what he realized, he grew up in the sticks in North Louisiana, and he was thinking about shotgun shells because it was squirrel season.
Okay.
And he goes, shotgun shells. So if you actually look, the way they separated the shuttle, it literally was like a shotgun shell going off. It pushed a pin, hit it, and boom, separated.
Leave it to a redneck to figure that out.
Leave it to a redneck, man. Dude, when he told me that, my eyes lit up, and I was like, this is the most genius redneck I've ever met in my life.
So the Apollo 13 spacecraft was made up of the Command Module 109 and Service Module 109. Together were the Command Service Module 109. It was called the Odyssey. It was followed up by the Lunar Module 7, called the Aquarius. Also considered for part of this spacecraft was the Launch Escape System, which would propel the Command Module to safety in case there was a problem. And the Spacecraft Lunar Module Adapter, which was numbered as SLA-16, which housed the Lunar Module during the first hours of the mission. The lunar module stages, guys, the command module and the service module, were received at the Kennedy Space Center in June of 1969. And then portions of the Saturn V rocket began to roll in June and July. After that, testing and assembly began, and the launch vehicle rolled out on December 15th of 1969. The mission, Apollo 13, was originally scheduled for launch on March 12th of 1970. And in January of that year, NASA announced that the mission would be postponed until April 11th, both to allow more time for planning and also to spread the missions over a longer period of time. And that reason was, the plan was to have two Apollo flights per year, and that was because of budgetary constraints. You know, we were getting less and less money.
So April 11th, 1969, where are we at?
Yeah, dude, we're about to launch. We are about to be a go for it. Now, right before they got ready to launch, there was an anomaly that had occurred when the second stage engine, the center engine, shut down abruptly. And it shut down approximately 2 minutes before it should have. This was caused by something called pogo oscillations. I have no idea what that means, and I'm going to leave it to Catfish to look that up and explain it to you real quick.
Yeah, basically it's where it vibrates to the point to where it can't get fuel.
Ah, nice.
Yeah, but in layman's terms.
Yes, Catfish explained it properly. Starting with Apollo 10, the vehicle's guidance system was designed to shut down the engine in case this had happened. But pogo oscillations had occurred on Titan rockets that were used during the Gemini program and even on previous Apollo missions. So they thought they knew how to handle this. But on Apollo 13, they were amplified by an interaction with the turbopump cavitation. So if cavitation means that it's going to blow something out. So with the cavitation and the oscillations, there was no way for this to properly pressurize and get fuel like it should have. So a fix to prevent this was ready, but the schedule did not permit the hardware's integration into the Apollo 13 spacecraft, which I think is going to come back to bite them later. A post-flight investigation revealed that the engine was only one cycle away from a catastrophic failure. Oh my gosh, man.
Well, you know, this whole thing, even the astronauts beforehand and some interviews they had, they had a level of, not, I won't say superstition, but there was always this bad vibe that they kind of discussed with the whole thing. And like, and it was kind of funny because I was like, if they spoke about that, you know, it had to be, in real life, it had to be even worse.
Yeah.
Like, everybody just had a bad idea, like a bad feeling about it.
So the crew begins to settle in, and with a TV camera running, the crew performed what was called a burn to place Apollo 13 on a hybrid trajectory. The departure from a free return trajectory meant that if no further burns were performed, Apollo 13 would miss Earth. Whoa.
Yeah.
We don't want to miss Earth, you know? Now, a free return trajectory could only reach sites near the lunar equator, and that was the way the math was done to get them there and back as efficiently as possible. Now, entry into the lunar module to test its systems were scheduled for 5,800 hours. When the crew awoke on the third day of the mission, they were informed that it had been moved up to just 3 hours and was later moved up again by another hour, giving them very little time to prepare the lunar module. A television broadcast was scheduled for 5,500 hours, and Lovell, who was going to be the MC, that would have been Catfish would have been doing. He would have been the man behind the mic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So he showed the audience the interiors of the Odyssey and Aquarius. Remember, part of the command service module and the lunar module that made up the Apollo 13 spacecraft. The audience was limited by the fact that none of the television networks were actually carrying the broadcast, forcing Marilyn Lovell, who was Jim Lovell's wife, to go to the VIP room at Mission Control just to see if she wanted to watch her husband and his crewmates. So they were filming, but when nobody was watching. Now, guys, we're about to really get into it. So before we get into it, we'd like to take a brief word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
So 6.5 minutes after the TV broadcast, they were about 200,000 miles from Earth, 210,000, somewhere up in there.
Wow, just six minutes away, and they were 200,000 miles.
Yeah, Hayes actually was completing the shutdown of the lunar module, and while testing the systems, that's when things kind of got lit.
So Lovell had stowed the TV camera, and Jack Luisma, I think I'm pronouncing that right, from Capcom, sent minor instructions to Swaggart, including changing the altitude of the craft so they could photograph the Comet Bennett that was getting ready to pass by. How beautiful would that be, man? Just to be in space, getting a first-hand view of a comet passing by. Wow.
Goals.
Yeah. The pressure sensor in one of the module's oxygen tanks earlier appeared to be malfunctioning. So Cy Liebergott from ECOM, who was in charge of monitoring the command service module's electrical system, requested a stirring of the tanks to be activated with fans. Now, normally this was done once daily, and the reason it's done is that a stir would de-stratify the contents of the tank, which in turn would make the pressure readings more accurate. So then the flight director, Krantz, had Liebergott wait just a few more minutes for the crew to settle down after the telecast, and then he relayed the request to Swaggart to activate the fans. And just after a few seconds, Swaggart turned them off again. 95 seconds after Swaggart activated those switches, the astronauts heard as what they were quoted as saying is a pretty large bang.
That's what you could hear in the beginning. I actually bumped that audio where you could hear it.
Yeah. After the bang, there were fluctuations in the electrical power and in the circuits that were firing of the altitude control thrusters. So things were starting to go crazy right now.
Well, you know, what the thing is, though, is the astronauts actually were kind of pranksters. And early on, there was a way you could actually pressurize the system and cause it to have a loud bang. And he would do it. One of the guys would do it just to scare the other two.
The nuts on these dudes,
but
man.
But when the loud bang happened, they looked at the guy that normally was the prankster with it. And he was just as terrified as they were. And they knew something was wrong.
Okay, so there's a gap in communications of roughly just under 2 seconds between the astronauts and their messages making to Earth and vice versa. And at that time, Swaggart was reported saying, "Houston, we've had a problem here." And at that time, it was echoed by Lovell saying, "Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main B bus undervolt."
You know, and that's what that phrase is so misused, because in the 1995 movie, the writer or screenwriter thought it didn't sound as terrifying as it could be, and it's suspenseful, and that's where Houston, we have a problem come from.
Oh, so he needed to sensationalize this even more?
Right, and that was his theory, and so since then, that's why everybody says it wrong.
Wow. So Lovell's first initial thought on hearing the noise was that Hayes had activated the lunar module's cabin repressurization valve, which also produced a bang. And this is what Hayes enjoyed scaring his crewmates with, that yep. Catfish was just mentioning.
Oh, yeah.
But Lovell, he could see that Hayes had no idea what was going on. He was freaking terrified as well. So Swaggart initially thought that maybe a meteoroid had struck the lunar module. Yeah, that's crazy too, man. But him and Lovell quickly realized there was no leak. The main bus B undervolt meant that there was insufficient voltage produced by the module's three fuel cells. And that was fueled by hydrogen and oxygen, which was piped in from their tanks separately and then mixed together to the second of the module's two electric power distribution systems.
So this all sounds really complicated and super sciencey.
But basically, it just means that the fuel and the electrical grid was going haywire at the exact same time due to pressurization issues.
And even as simple as on an older car, the voltmeter drops, you go, why did I lose power? Is the alternator going out? Is the battery going out? Same concept. That's all it was.
Yeah. Now, practically everything in the command service module needed power to function. And although the bus momentarily returned to its normal status, soon both buses A and B were low on voltage, and that was going to make all the systems start screwing up. So Hayes checked the status of each of the fuel cells and found that two of the three cells were now dead. Mission rules forbade the crew from entering the lunar orbit unless all fuel cells were operational. So at this point, the mission was scrubbed.
Done.
Yeah. In the minutes after the accident, there were tons of crazy readings all over the place. Some showed that tank 2 was empty. Some showed that tanks 1's pressure was slowly dropping, and that the computer on board the spacecraft had completely reset its system, and that the high gain antenna was also not working. So they're beginning to get screwed. Liebergott initially missed the worrying signs from Tank 2 following that stir that was so catastrophic, as he was focusing on Tank 1, believing that that's where the problem was. And when Kranz questioned Liebergott on this, he initially responded that there might be false readings due to an instrumentation problem. And he was often teased about it in the years after that. So they did not let this man live it down.
No.
Yeah. So meanwhile, Lovell, who was looking out the window, reported seeing a gas of some sort venting into space, making it clear that there was a serious, serious, serious freaking problem. I mean, can you imagine that, dude?
Oh, I can. You know how?
How?
Man, I grew up in poverty. We had crap cars. We had $500 cars. But you know, the only difference is where they seen gas coming out and they seen the vapors when they looked outside.
Uh-huh.
We had to worry when you couldn't see smoke because that meant you ran out of oil. As long as you could see smoke in the back of the car coming out, you were okay. You got oil in it.
But see, all you had to do was get out of the car. There wasn't no, let's just get out of the Lunar Command module.
Oh, that's what everyone, I keep thinking about to the car. I'm comparing the shuttle itself to a car. And I'm like, okay, and so it's making the instrumentation make sense, everything else, and especially the voltage dropping would be like your alternator going out. If you're in a car, oh well. If you're 200,000 miles from Earth, not good.
Yeah. So since the fuel cells needed oxygen to operate, when oxygen tank 1 first began to run dry, the remaining fuel cell would shut down. And that means that the command service module's only main source of power and oxygen would be from the command module's battery and its oxygen surge tank. So that's very, very little power, very, very little oxygen. And these would be needed for the final hours of the mission. But the remaining fuel cell that was already low on oxygen was drawing from the surge tank, eating up that supply of oxygen. Now, Kranz ordered the surge tank isolated, saving that little bit of oxygen. But this meant that the remaining fuel cell would die within just a few hours, and they would be stuck. Now, as oxygen in tank 1 was consumed or leak away, the volume surrounding the spacecraft was filled with a whole bunch of small bits of debris from the accident, and that complicated things even worse. So that's when the mission control's goal became to just get these astronauts back home safely.
Well, you see, okay, so I remember hearing one of the few things I knew about this was the navigation side of things. They had to do stuff that they've never done before, and they didn't even think was possible.
Okay, let's go through some of that.
Yeah, so they actually had to use, but instead of using the stars for a reference, because that's how you judged where you were at, and that's a lot of it.
That's
like
amazing.
Like a ship on the ocean, you know.
Yeah, I was just fixing to say that.
Yeah, you literally use the stars for your navigation. They did the same thing with these shuttles. Well, the problem is all that debris and everything around them, they had to start using the computers and stuff for all the navigation. Where are we at? Whatever. And it's never been done before. I mean, luckily they could tell, obviously, they could figure it out.
Yeah. So there was so much debris around the module that they could not fly by means of visual usage.
And they had to go purely to the computer.
Yeah. Which there are two different types of pilot ratings, actually, when you get into your first levels of becoming a pilot. One of those is called VFR. The other is called IFR. Obviously, the V stands for visual. The I stands for instrument, which means you cannot see it all. You strictly have to fly by these instruments. And it takes skill. It really does.
Oh, man. Yeah. No, well, this entire mission was about skill.
Oh,
I mean, this absolutely. Is wits and skill is all this was. Yeah. And balls.
Yeah.
Lots of big balls.
Lots of balls here.
Who's got big balls? Those guys have big balls.
So they've got a loop around the moon, guys. The lunar module had charged both batteries and had charged batteries and a full oxygen tank for use while on the lunar surface. So that's when Kranz directed that the astronauts power up the lunar module and basically use it as a life raft. And they had considered this scenario before in training, but they considered it very, very unlikely. Now, procedures for using the lunar module in this way have been developed by lunar module flight controllers after training simulation for Apollo 10, in which the lunar module was needed for survival but could not be powered up in time. Now, had Apollo 13's accident occurred on the return cycle of this, with the lunar module already jettisoned, they would have died because they would not have had access to this.
Well, that's the thing about these with the with space missions. When something goes wrong, normally there's no return. I mean, it's done. Think of the Challenger. Think of numerous other shuttle incidents.
Yeah.
And usually it's just boom, everybody's gone.
Yeah.
Well, this is a series of events to where they still stayed afloat. And it was pure luck. And then, like we said earlier, wits.
So they had to make a real big decision about the return path to make it back to Earth. And a direct abort, as it was referred to, would cause the service module's main engine, which was called the Service Propulsion System, or SPS for short, made it to return before reaching the moon. But the accident could have damaged the SPS and the corresponding fuel cells that would have to last for at least another hour to meet these power requirements. So they didn't have that either. In turn, Kranz instead decided on a longer route. And the reason was that the spacecraft would swing around the moon before heading back to Earth. And Apollo 13 was on a hybrid trajectory, which was to take it from Mararo, it now was to be brought back to a free return. Now,
that's awesome. It is to me, this is just the coolest part of any of this. Yeah.
The lunar module's descent propulsion system, the DPS, although not as powerful as the SPS, could in theory do this. But new software for Mission Control's computers needed to be written by techs, as had never been contemplated that the Command Service Module or the Lunar Module spacecraft would have to be maneuvered from the Lunar Module. So basically, you've got guys in Mission Control who are actively writing code at this point. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, my grandfather was Strategic Air Command with the Air Force.
I did not know that.
Yes. And he did 20 years in Vietnam, the whole nine yards. He was telling me he picked up on computers when he was like probably in his late 60s. But he could email people, and it was on dial-up. It was old computer, it was old school. But, man, he could use a computer like nobody I've ever seen before for
that
the time.
That is really cool.
Even at his age. And I asked him, but he never did computers, or he wasn't a science-y guy. But he was an aeronautical engineer maintenance.
Cool.
And first staff sergeant. Dude, and I asked him one day, I said, how did you pick up on computers so well? And this is in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
And he just grinned and he goes, man, we had the same ones back in the 60s and 70s. They were a lot bigger and they were a lot less easy to use.
But still, the same thing going on.
It's the same thing. And that's what everybody thinks of, 52-year-old. This is 52-year-old technology.
Man.
52 years old. Yeah.
So as the As the command module was being shut down, Lovell began to copy its guiding system's orientation information and performed hand calculations to transfer it to the lunar module's guiding system, which had been turned off at the request of Mission Control so they could begin to check figures. So basically what he was doing was hand copying down all the math and things that were needed to go and plug it into the lunar module so that it could have this trajectory plugged into its path. The change would get Apollo 13 back to Earth in about 4 days' time, with a hopeful splashdown in the Indian Ocean.
That is a long time to be on a burning rocket in the middle of space.
With everything going wrong. The longest 4 days ever. So a man named Jerry Bostick and other flight dynamics officers, who were referred to as FIDOs, were anxious both to shorten the travel time and to move splashdown from the Indian Ocean over to the Pacific Ocean, where the main recovery forces were located. Right, so we could get these guys.
Yeah, I don't think they had hardly anybody in the Indian Oceans was a problem.
Well, they had a backup crew, basically. But with all this going on, they needed the A-team there. Now, one option would shave 36 hours off of the return time, but it required jettisoning the service module. This would expose the command module's heat shield to space during the return journey, something that it was not designed to do. The Fidos also proposed several other solutions, and after a meeting involving national officials and engineers, a senior individual present named Robert R. Gilruth decided on a burn using the DPS system, and that would save 12 hours instead of the 36, and it would land Apollo 13 in the Pacific Ocean. Basically, this was referred to as the PC plus 2 burn, and it would take place 2 hours after, oh, I wrote this down, but I'm not sure, after Paracention?
I think you're closer than I could get.
Which that means it's the closest approach to the moon.
Which is kind of cool. Like, you literally get right up against the moon.
Yeah. Now, at the Paracention, Apollo 13 set the record, and it's still in the Guinness World Book of Records to this day, for the highest absolute altitude attained by a crewed spacecraft, which was 400,171 kilometers from Earth.
For you Americans, that is about 250,000 miles, yes. If my math is right.
248,655 to be exact. And that was achieved at 7:21 p.m. Eastern Time on April the 14th. So while preparing for the burn, this crew was told that the SIVB had impacted the moon as planned, leading Lovell to quip, well, at least something worked on this flight. give them a small victory, you know.
At least one thing worked.
Yeah. So the white team of Krantzis had mission controllers who spent most of their time supporting other teams and developing the procedures that were needed to get the astronauts home. So they are literally coming up with this stuff moment by moment as it happens. Absolutely. Seat of their pants. Normally, the accuracy of such a burn would be assured by checking the alignment Lovell had transferred to the lunar module's computer against the position of a star or such. But the light glinting off many pieces of the debris that was around the spacecraft made that almost impossible. So the astronauts used the one star they had available whose position could not be obscured, the sun.
So we actually joked about this beforehand.
We did.
And what Josh and I decided was if we were on the shuttle together, and I could see us getting stuck on the shuttle going around, if we would happen to miss Earth, we would just aim it at the sun.
Yeah.
Just it. Four rockets to the sun. I know the math isn't there and it's not going to reach it. I don't care. That's what we would do.
I'm not freezing to death. I like it warm, guys.
That's it. We're going to get as warm as we can.
Yeah. Houston also informed them that the moon would be centered into the commander's window of the lunar module as they made the burn, which was a great reference point. It was almost perfect, less than 0.3 meters per second off. And that is really, really close to be doing things on the fly. The burn lasted 4 minutes and 23 seconds. And at this time, the crew shut down the lunar module systems to conserve any more power, oxygen. If they didn't need it, they weren't using it at this point. Jeez. And that's where they begin to return to Earth, guys. The lunar module carried enough oxygen, but still had the problem of not being able to remove carbon dioxide. And that was absorbed by the canisters that were full of lithium hydroxide pellets. But the lunar module stock of canisters that were meant to accommodate two astronauts for 45 hours on the moon was not enough to support three astronauts to come back to Earth. But the command module had enough canisters, but they were the wrong shape and size to work within the lunar module's equipment. See,
that would aggravate the mess out of me, dude.
That should have been interchangeable. Yeah.
Well, that's what, you know, the military, that's what they found out is, that's why you run diesel in pretty much everything. Yeah. So you can use the same fuel for all your vehicles. Yeah. And then on top of that, a lot of your artillery rounds are the same size. Yeah.
So meanwhile, engineers on the ground devised a way to bridge the gap using plastic covers ripped from manuals of all things, duct tape, and whatever else they could find inside the modules.
Out of here, dude. Jesus Christ, these guys. These are some of the most brilliant human beings.
But you missed the key thing here. They have a roll of duct tape aboard the space shuttle.
And if you can't duct it, you just don't use... Yeah, no, it's not going to work.
Exactly. Yeah. Duct tape for everything.
Duct tape to everything.
The engineers referred to the improvised device as the mailbox.
This is the coolest thing ever.
The procedure for building this device was read to the crew by Capcom
person. Joseph Kerwin. Kerwin, yeah, I think Kerwin. Was his name. Kerwin.
Yeah. Over the course of an hour, and it was built by Swaggart and Hayes, okay? The carbon dioxide levels began dropping almost immediately.
Genius bastards.
Gosh, that's so awesome. Lovell later described this improvisation as a fine example of cooperation between the ground and the space.
The guys we talked about that don't get enough credit.
Exactly. And everything had to be on point. Everything had to be just great between them, you know?
See, I kept thinking of us as being in the shuttle, right? I think that we would have been the ground guys. I'm going to go ahead and say, no, I ain't
that smart. Either one of us could pass a physical and get to
that. Yeah, I'm not that smart. I could not have done the ground. I could have thought of the duct tape.
Let me Google something, guys.
As a guy that works as a sound engineer, duct tape is my best friend.
So the command service module's electricity came from fuel cells that produce water as a byproduct. But the lunar module was powered by zinc silver batteries, which it did not. So both the electrical power and the water needed for equipment cooling as well as drinking would be very, very critical. They would have just enough. The lunar module power consumption was reduced even more to the lowest level that they could get by with. Swaggart was able to fill some drinking bags with water from the command module's water tap. But even assuming rationing of personal consumption, Hayes initially calculated that they would run out of water for cooling at about 5 hours before re-entry.
Where do you need the most cooling at?
Exactly, when you're re-entering. This seemed acceptable because the systems of Apollo 11's lunar module once jettisoned into lunar orbit and had continued to operate for 7 to 8 hours even with the water cut off. So it could theoretically go past the parameters that it was designed for. But in the end, Apollo 13 returned to Earth with 12.8 kilograms, roughly 28 pounds of water remaining. So they did a very good job of rationing out what they needed to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The crew's ration, believe it or not, guys, was only 0.2 liters of water per person per day.
That's it. I quit. I cannot work. I cannot work underneath these circumstances.
7 ounces of water in the most stressful situation you could ever imagine yourself being in.
I'm done. Is there a beer? Nope.
The three astronauts ended up losing a total of 31 pounds between them. And Hayes developed a UTI while in space. But it should be said that astronauts in space are roughly 25 times more likely to develop a UTI than someone here on Earth.
Random Josh fact.
Yeah.
The more you know.
This infection was probably caused by the reduced water intake, but microgravity and effects of cosmic radiation have also impaired his immune system to react to this. So next thing you know, they're in this darkened spacecraft. The temperature had dropped as low as 38 degrees.
If I'm right, they actually spoke about the water. Like, remember we said they only had that little bit of water?
Uh-huh.
One of the astronauts in an interview when he was older, right before he passed away, actually said that he remembered the water freezing. Like, literally, your drinking water froze.
Oh, wow.
Because, I mean, it was so cold inside the capsule.
So, Lovell considered having the crew put on their spacesuits, but this was actually going to make them too hot. Instead, I know, they can't get anything
can't
to work
win
with.
Can't win for anything.
Yeah. Lovell and Hayes wore their lunar EVA boots, and Swaggart put on an extra coverall. All of the astronauts were still cold, especially Swaggart, who had just got his feet wet while filling the water bags and had no lunar overshoes.
Screw this.
Yeah, since he wasn't supposed to walk on the moon, so he did not have that, you know, any type of covering with them. As they had been told not to discharge their urine to space to avoid disturbing their trajectory, really, jettisoning your pee can change the trajectory of your orbit?
At this point, I'm going to take it that anything can screw everything up.
I will agree. So they had to store it in water bags. Could you imagine grabbing the wrong bag?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
oh yeah. I did 10 years in oil. I did 10 years in oil field. Those work trucks, it happens.
Oh, man. Water began to condense on the wall. And through any condensation that was happening, actually was beginning to happen behind the equipment panels. And that's no bueno. Now, partly it wasn't good because of the extensive electrical insulation and stuff that had to be situated back there. Flight controller John Aaron, along with Mattingly, who was mentioned earlier, and several other engineers and designers devised a procedure for powering up the command service module from full shutdown, something that had never been attempted in flight, much less under Apollo 13's severe power and time constraints that they were dealing with. So the astronauts implemented this procedure without any apparent difficulty. So this went off without a hitch, and that's amazing. Kranz later was credited the fact that all three astronauts had been test pilots and that they were accustomed to having to work in critical conditions with their lives on the line.
So, well, yeah, I mean, it's either do or die. I mean, might as well just do.
Yeah. So, I mean, the right men for the right job.
Oh, man, I could... These guys were badasses.
Yeah. So despite the accuracy of them making it back to Earth with their trajectory, the spacecraft began to drift off course. And that would scare me.
It's because Josh put the pee out the window when I told him not to.
Dude, I had to go. As the lunar module's guidance system had been shut down following the PC2 burn, the crew was told to use the line between night and day on the Earth to guide them. Holy crap.
Yeah. Wow. That's what I was telling you. Like, it was so close. Yeah. Now, I mean, can you imagine just missing?
So that technique by using night and day is a technique that was used on NASA's Earth orbit missions, but never on the way back from the moon. So once again, this had never been done in practice. Now, this DPS burn brought the projected entry flight path angle back within safe limits, so they were able to correct that. Nevertheless, yet another burn was going to be needed using the lunar module's reaction control system and its thrusters for about 21 and a half seconds. So the service module was jettisoned less than half an hour later, allowing the crew to see the damage for the first time and to take pictures of it. And I'm going to have to get those pictures.
Well, yeah, we're uploading them to the to our Instagram and on the gam, on the gram.
Yeah.
And we're in script. We'll load them up on the gam and up on Facebook and stuff for everybody.
The astronauts reported that an entire panel was missing from the service module's exterior. The fuel cells above the oxygen tanks were actually tilted off kilter, and that the high-gain antenna was damaged, and that there was also considerable amounts of debris just everywhere. Hayes could see possible damage to the service module's engine bell, validating Kranz's decision not to use the SPS thrusters, which is great.
Yeah, this reminds me of the 1995 Mazda Protege. I used a duct tape and a dog leash to hold the hood down so that I could drive it all the way down to spring break in Florida.
Oh, wow. So, guys, we've got another problem. The last problem that needed to be solved was to separate the lunar module at a safe distance away from the command module just before reentry. The normal procedure when everything's going right in lunar orbit was to release the lunar module and then to use the service module's RCS to pull the command service module away from the lunar module, basically have them separate at a safe distance before reentry begins. Now, Grumman, the manufacturer of the lunar module, assigned a team of University of Toronto engineers who was led by senior scientist Bernard Etkin to solve the problem of just how much air pressure was going to be needed to push the modules apart. The astronauts applied the solution and it happened successfully. So then the lunar module re-entered Earth's atmosphere and was destroyed, with the remaining pieces falling deep into the ocean.
Wish I had my hands on some of those.
Oh, man.
eBay, here I come.
Apollo 13's final mid-course correction had addressed the concerns of the Atomic Energy Commission, of all people, which wanted the cask containing the plutonium oxide intended for the rig to land in a safe place. The impact point was over the Tonga Trench in the Pacific, which is one of the deepest points in the ocean, and the cask sank more than 6 miles to the bottom. Later, helicopter surveys found no traces of radioactive leakage.
Okay, after I survived all this, kiss my ass if there's a potential radiation leak in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, man. Do you know that metals and stuff that has been into space and does not have any radioactive properties to it are actually extremely, extremely high priced. Like,
oh, because you can hold them in your hand.
There are recovery missions and salvage operations that are just, if not more profitable than certain treasure hunting explorations to retrieve this stuff.
Yeah, and I actually want to do a podcast on this right here. Man, meteors and stuff that hit the Earth and, like, objects from outer space, there are, like, people that go chasing after these things.
Yeah.
Like, their full-time job is literally to find them.
Yeah.
I always thought it was kind of fascinating.
Now, ionization of the air around the command module during reentry would typically cause a 4-minute communications blackout. Now, Apollo 13's shallow reentry path lengthened this to up to 6 minutes. Mm-hmm. So there was going to be what felt like forever before they could hear from these astronauts again.
Do not want to be the ground guys.
Yeah.
Okay, like in this, because they don't know what's going on. The astronauts are like, hey, I'm still alive. But the people on the ground, they're like, I don't know if they're still alive or not.
Yeah. At this point, Odyssey regained radio contact and splashed down safely into the South Pacific Ocean. And it happened southeast of American Samoa at around 3.5 nautical miles from the recovery ship, the USS Iwo Jima. So after all this to have happened, it splashed down just 3 miles away from the recovery team.
That's badass.
Awesome.
Dude, you went from everything falling apart to going around the moon to landing 3 miles from where you planned to.
And just going to bob in the ocean waiting on them.
How cool is that?
Although they were extremely fatigued and absolutely wore out, the crew were all in good condition except for Hayes, who had at this point developed a serious urinary tract infection because of insufficient water intake. But hey, he's on the ground. He is back in Earth.
But you know, when they, I don't know if it was Hayes or who it was. And it, you know, if he had a UTI, it makes sense now. When they were orbiting around the moon, only two of the astronauts actually took video and photographs. There was a third that was like, I am done with this crap, and I'm sitting back. And I wonder if it was Hayes that sat back.
I would think it would be him. You're not feeling well.
Now it makes sense. He may not felt well, and that's why it was. One of the other astronauts made a comment about it and said, "You know, while you know, we were all excited and taking videos, the other guy was just like, nope, and just chilling."
So the crew stayed overnight on the ship and flew to Pago Pago, American Samoa. I believe that's right.
Oh, that's an interesting name.
Yeah, just within the very next day, they then flew to Hawaii, where President Richard Nixon awarded them the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
You are damn right the president better be waiting on my ass when I get home.
And guys, if you don't know, the Presidential Medal of Freedom is the highest civilian honor that can be awarded to you. Yeah,
they stayed overnight. I imagine they had a beer or two with Nixon.
And a giant steak.
Oh, I don't know, man. I don't know if I could eat after all that.
I would be eating everything. Absolutely everything.
And, man, then they flew back to Houston.
Yeah. So, en route to Honolulu, President Nixon stopped at Houston to award the Presidential Medal of Freedom to the Apollo 13 mission operations team.
One for the guys on the ground.
Everybody got,
that's right,
got a medal. He originally planned to give the award to NASA Administrator Thomas O. Paine, but Paine was like, nah, these guys, these are the ones who need it. I think that's pretty awesome of them.
That is a cool dude.
Yeah.
I'm not a hero. So, some may call me a hero.
So worldwide interest in the Apollo program was reawakened by the incident, and the television coverage was seen by millions and millions of people. 4 Soviet ships headed toward the landing area to assist if needed. And that should say
when
a lot.
When the Soviets jump in 1970 to help you.
Yeah, the Cold War, but still that, like, and that's awesome, you know? Yeah. That just lets you know that 99% of people in this world are good people. And it's that 1% who just try and screw everything up for all the rest of us. The rescue received more public attention than any space flight at that point, even more than the first moon landing on Apollo 11. That's crazy. There were worldwide headlines everywhere. People were all over their TV sets, just glued to it, trying to see the next developments and what was going to happen and just to be kept updated. And everybody was just in on this. Now, an estimated 40 million Americans watched the Apollo 13 splashdown and was carried live on all 3 networks. You hear that, guys? We had 3 networks at the time.
All 3 major networks.
And watched another 30 million watching some portion of the 6.5 one-hour telecast.
That's right. And we're going to get 100,000 listens on this episode.
So, guys, that was the Apollo 13 mission. We'd like to thank you guys for listening. We just are probably going to hit about the hour or so mark for this one. So this marks our longest episode to date. We'd like to thank you guys for sticking around. Make sure to check us out on Facebook at Lost in Thought, Instagram at Stay Lost in Thought, YouTube at Lost in Thought Media. And Daniel, what do you got for us?
Well, if you like goose eggs after the credit rolls at the end of the movies, I just want to let everybody know, stick around after at the end of this.
Oh, nice, buddy. Well, hey, guys, that's a wrap. Across from me is Daniel. I'm Josh. Remember, not all who wander are lost. Till next time, guys, stay lit.
Now coming to the moment, the last moments of Apollo 13 as it comes in, as it begins its re-entry. The best thing we can do now is just to listen and hope.
The last few seconds down to re-entry. At this point, there's very little anybody can do, including the astronauts, except wait as they come in through the uppermost fringes of the Earth's atmosphere. The computers put them on course. All anybody can do now is cross their fingers.
Apollo Control, Houston. We've just had loss of signal from Honeysuckle.
And they are coming in faster than predicted. They're coming in just about as fast as any spacecraft has returned from space before. The last few seconds now to re-entry, and they've lost them on the main radio contact antenna in Australia at Honeysuckle Creek. Just about now, they should be going through the moment of maximum heat. And we'll only know whether or not that heat shield was damaged by the explosion 3 days ago, when they come out of radio blackout in just over 2 minutes.
Our last estimate for max G was 5.2 Gs.
About 30 seconds to go to the end of radio blackout
about
now.
About 30 seconds to go. For blackout. Less than 10 seconds now, we will attempt to contact Apollo 13 through one of the Araya aircraft. Continuing to monitor this, Apollo Control, Houston. We've had a report that Araya 4 aircraft has acquisition of signal.
They're through.
Odyssey, Houston, standing by, over. Okay, we read you, Jack.
That was Jim Lovell responding with the okay, Joe. Correction there, that was Command Module Pilot Jack Swigert.
We're looking at the weather on TV and it looks just as advertised, real good.
Less than 2 minutes now from time of drogue deployment.
That drogue deployment that he's talking about is the point at which the very small parachutes come out that then drag up the main parachutes. They have been seen before those drogue parachutes come out on previous missions, but today all we can be certain of is that everybody's watching for those small red and white parachutes to come out to signal the final safety stage of this flight. The main parachutes. Let's not anticipate. But the heat shield obviously worked. Should see something anytime now.
Odyssey, Houston, standing by for your noun 67 when you get it, over.
The chute should be out.
A report of two good drogues coming up now for main chutes. Standing by for confirmation of main chutes.
There they are.
There they are. They've made it.
all three chutes out. Listen to the crowd on the boat.
We show you on the mains. It really looks great.
An extremely loud applause here in Mission Control.
Visual.
An extremely loud applause as Apollo 13 on main chutes comes through loud and clear on the television display here.
Venting. Yes, venting the last of the fuel there. You saw that smoke go up?
We have a report from the Iwo Jima that Apollo 13 at a distance of 4 miles from the ship.
4 miles?
The smoke you see is venting of RCS propellants, reaction control system propellants.
According to 5,000. Under Apollo 13, this is recovery, and your chutes look good.
And they're in, and I make it no more, no more than 5 seconds late. No more than 5 seconds late.
As we had splashed down.
Well, the one splashed down at this time, the three shoes are displaced in the water.
3.5 miles from Iwo Jima.
This one, the command module is stable one at this time. They're riding comfortably.
And they've landed the right way up. Helicopter going in there to drop a flare for the wind direction for the other helicopters. Look at the heat scarring on the side of that module. I think this picture you're seeing must be, for the first time, the picture from the television camera in one of the recovery helicopters.
This is photo one, the Mylar covering on the exterior of the command module has been removed in the area opposite the two access hatch. From the approximately 1 to 2 feet.
Helicopter there reporting 1 to 2 foot waves and a swell going from 3 to 5 feet.
Interrogative astronaut condition order. 401, roger, bring to Apollo 13. Is the crew condition okay, over?
Very good, sir. We're just going to be in the
front. Roger. Copy, Iwo Jima. Iwo Jima, copy.
The crew there saying they're in very good shape. The retrieval operation beginning there in one, less than 1 minute from now. Swim helicopter one going into its first position to drop the swimmers.
Swim two has recovery. You're clear to deploy one swimmer at the sea anchor. Swim two, roger.
Here goes the first swimmer to put in the sea anchor. Attaches the sea anchor to prevent the module drifting too far. These pictures you're seeing come from the television camera on board one of the helicopters hovering over the command module at this time.
Photo 1, observe the operating bag proportionally inflated at this time. At the moment, we have a good look at the
crew. Odyssey there, the crew confirming that they dumped all of their fuel successfully. Here comes the first helicopter with the first swimmer. And there he goes.
The first swimmer has been deployed.
Swimming towards the command module.
In good condition.
Carrying the sea anchor.
He is making his way to the command module.